Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Content Rookie. Today's episode reminds me a little bit more of the episodes I used to record when I first started Content Rookie. It's a very casual conversation, we didn't plan it out a lot, and we're just essentially talking about what we love about content design. It's a very positive episode, really, sharing our experiences, and I think that's a nice thing to put out in these times as well. We don't even mention AI, we don't mention layoffs, which feels like a record at this point. So I do hope you enjoyed this episode with my friend Nayara. It's a short one, we only chatted for roughly 25 minutes, but I do hope you'll enjoy a little bit of a positive boost when you listen to this. Thank you so much for listening to Content Rookie. This is Nicole. Welcome to Content Rookie, Ayara. Please introduce yourself to the listeners.
Hi, everyone. I'm Yara Lucena. I'm a content designer. I have been doing this work for the past 6 years with different role name changes in between UX writer, content designer. Yeah, I'm originally from Brazil, living in the Netherlands for the past 13 years. One of two beautiful boys. Aww. Yeah, and this is me in a nutshell. So thanks for having me here today, Nicole.
I'm very excited to have you here today, Ayara. I'm really happy that we're getting together to have a little bit of a more casual conversation about content design. We've worked a little bit together in the past, so we definitely have some shared experiences there as well. But I would love to just, you know, paint a little bit of a more in-depth picture of like your trajectory in content design. What first got you into content design? How did you get there?
So basically we have to go back to when I actually started working here in the Netherlands. Of course, I came from Brazil right after I graduated. I have a background in psychology. And one of the challenges that I had here is that it's not very easy to work with psychology directly doing what I thought I would be doing, which is the therapy, helping people that way, if you don't speak yet the language. And we're looking at a time where there was not yet a lot of technology, like nowadays you see people doing therapy online, you know, and coaching online, but that was not the case. And I was like, okay, I have to figure out a career here. So I started looking at other jobs that I could do. And I actually started working with writing for UX and so in Brazilian Portuguese. So I was actually a translator and I started my career in UX that way. So initially was just translating from English to Brazilian Portuguese, and then started learning a lot about actually how to adjust the language to the different scenarios, and the role itself started evolving to language specialist. I also did some other lateral movements, like I was also a product owner for content. So there I was learning a lot more about the technical side of content, developing tooling, improving tooling for translators and editors. But after a while, I was like, no, you know what? I had to make some decisions based on personal reasons to go back to being a language specialist. I was like, this feels familiar. This feels like it's a very good place to go back to. And then I went back, but with a lot of the things that I had learned also about the more technical side of content, I was like, okay, I feel again like it's time for a different move. And then that was the first time where I applied for a UX writer position and to write in English. So going to the other side, sort of speaking. And that's a little bit how my career in UX started and developed in the beginning here.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think it's also very similar to how a lot of us kind of got into the field from another type of background. In your case, psychology, and a lot of people come from journalism or other fields. And it's always a good reminder for everyone interested in content design that if you're into it, there's usually a way into it.
That's true.
I'm curious to hear. So the first time then you started working as a UX writer, how did you feel about that? Did you feel like, yeah, this is like great, I love doing this? Did you have hesitations from the beginning? The reason I like to ask this question is that for me, when I first transitioned into content design, it was kind of like almost like a revelation. I really enjoyed it much more than the work I had been doing previously, mostly on marketing teams. So in the beginning, I still remember that I felt like so lucky to get to work with it. I'm curious to hear if it was similar for you.
Yeah, no, it was very similar indeed. I think one of the big changes that happened there was that the whole, like when you are on the side of writing source text, I know it's a very technical term, but when you're writing the source text, and in this case was in English, you start being exposed to a whole different world of factors that are taken into account. I was already looking into UX because also from my background, I started studying in UX when I was translating. But then when I shifted to actually writing, you start working closely with a lot of other disciplines, research, designers, product managers, also engineers, developers in that sense. And that exchange uncovered a lot of other things that I was not able to consider before. And that really changed the way that I was thinking also about what I was writing, you know? So I actually got exposed to a whole new world with a lot of different information that was actually very helpful, you know? And I got really excited because, you know, I always liked writing. I used to write poems when I was younger and that kind of stuff. So writing was always there, but this is a very specific, more technical specialist kind of writing, and I started like to learn how to do that kind of writing as well. So that was really exciting.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. And I'm curious to hear, to kind of follow up on this whole thread, what are some of your favorite things about working in content design or working as a UX writer?
I think are those moments when you are trying to, like, I really like the part of the work that is like when you're really trying to bring clarity to things. I think that has a lot to do, like, everybody has also their own personal way of writing. My process a little bit, I write all the bad ideas, the good ideas, everything mixed, you know. I also can write really long things first, and then the process of clarifying those things and see it take a different shape. And then especially when you start exposing it to feedback, asking feedback from others, you know, like, what do you think about this? I like to also expose the copy, for example, that I'm writing a bit before it's ready. Sometimes it can be a bit unclear because some people might be expecting that thing that you're writing to already be final. But in my process, I'm like, no, it's not final yet. But that process of seeing the copy transform, you know, and sometimes it's completely different at the end. Sometimes you just get it right the first time, and that's amazing. That process is very exciting to me. And it's like also thinking about like how that's going to impact people. It's the other side that's a bit more subtle, you know, like the people who are actually going to read this in a way that is not just figuring out if it's good enough. They're not even going to be thinking if it's good or not, but is it going to help them? That's the whole behavior and the emotional impact the copy can have as well on people. You know, that's exciting to me, you know? Like, you don't see how people are reacting. I wish I could be there right next to them when they're reading. But that doesn't happen. But thinking about that is exciting.
Sometimes that happens in user research. I was just involved in some user research, and one of the people we were basically talking to in the session was a little bit of a power user. And the first thing he said was like, yeah, I just want to say, like, the tone of voice is awesome. Like, every little bit of copy, I always love it. And then he was clicking around. We were showing, like, a new experience. And he was like, yeah, I really love this. Like, the terminology here is so simple. And I don't think he was aware that, like, there was even going to be a content designer or, like, a UX writer on the other side. But when I watched that recording, I was like, oh, that's so nice that he actually likes it and he called it out. So it happens very rarely, like you say. But that was actually a really nice moment.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That's really exciting to hear that kind of stuff. I think in general, when you're doing research, you're probably expecting people to not even notice your copy sometimes.
Which is also good.
Or just notice the one that will print it specifically
to
call their attention, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it can also be good if they don't notice your copy at all, because maybe, you know, you made a tweak that was so intuitive that it didn't have to be called out. So, yeah, I think that's really fascinating. But while we're talking about, like, you know, all those things that give us the fuzzy feelings, What, in your opinion, now you've been working in the field for quite some time as well, what would you say are some of the challenges that you're still facing, content design is still facing?
Yeah, I think it's like figuring out, like the figuring out the way of working, you know. There's so much around there that it's like anytime you're shaping up content design practice somewhere, there are some very specific challenges that happen there. And you are fully aware, for example, that those challenges exist, but people on the other side are not yet thinking on the same, you know, wavelength as you yet, because it could be that they're so deep into their processes and there is a reason for that. There are priorities, there are goals to be met. And like whenever you're coming with a new discipline in, and there's the discipline is still growing. So more and more companies are starting to hire content designers. So that process there of like getting the same wavelength or really understanding what the needs are, you already know the things that need to be done. You have to adjust, of course, to the place where you work in. I'm not even talking about different companies, but sometimes different places in the same company have different needs. And like that part, I think it remains a challenge, because you have to know what are the basic things, and you know already as a content designer that are gonna help lead to success, are gonna help to lead to copy quality. But sometimes people don't know that yet. So there's the education advocacy part. And sometimes it's an awareness switch that has to be clicked, like, yeah, I'm here to support, but I also need some stuff to be able to do the work, and being clear about those things is important.
Yeah, I hear you. I think it's, for me, the older I get and the longer I work in this field, the more I just feel like there really is no one size fits all. I don't even think really there is best practice. I know there's a lot of books and courses and opinions and very good guides. And like, I think all of those are great and I'm glad they're out there. But I also feel like whenever I start a new project at a new company, in a new product team, a lot of the things that maybe worked in my previous project will suddenly not apply, and I need to figure it out again from scratch. And sometimes I have come in and I've thought like, oh, I'll just, you know, basically duplicate what worked at this other place or in this other team. And then I run into problems and I kind of need to figure it out again, in terms of, you know, how do you build the relationships? How do you manage stakeholders, ways of working?
Yeah.
I just feel like there's no standard yet. Maybe that's a good thing, because I think that can also be more inclusive to different types of people and different working styles. And I think it can also be a good thing for companies that are in general open to change and figuring things out. But I think it's also one of the big, big challenges, because I think it makes the job a lot more exhausting. And for me, there's only been very few positions that I've worked in as a content designer where I haven't felt somewhat isolated and alone, even when there were other content designers, because there's so much you as an individual have to figure out with your projects and your stakeholders and your teams, even if there is a standard. So I think in a way it's almost a little bit of an emotional job. I don't know, maybe that's just my way of looking at it.
No, I think I can relate a lot to that. I think it's a job that involves a lot of sense making, and sense making is never easy, because, you know, sometimes you do it alone, sometimes you do it together. There is always that, like, understanding it for yourself, but also collectively understanding how something is working or not working, you know? So there's a lot of sense making. So yeah, it's the whole story about, we probably spend 15 to 20% of our time doing some writing, the other 80%, we are really trying to figure out all these nuances of dynamics and needs as well, you know, that will actually help to get the work done.
Yeah, I agree. I think I wrote this in one of my more recent articles, but a big learning for me, at least over the last year, has been that so much, like, the content design success you have depends, I would say, like, I don't know, yeah, 80%, 90%, but it depends so much on the story you tell. Like, yeah. You can make a really shitty microcopy suggestion, but if the story you tell stakeholders and decision makers, like why you're making this recommendation, is good enough, they will mm-hmm. go for it. Or you can have a brilliant microcopy suggestion and like a lot of data to back that, but if the story you tell them doesn't feel good enough, they might still not go with it. And I think that's a really challenging part of the job, because oftentimes in situations where that story needs to be told, you as a content designer may not be in the room. So someone else kind of has to know the story well enough to tell it for you, or it needs to be clear from the context that is being looked at. And that, I think, is a really tricky thing. And whenever I talk to people or I think about scaling content design, this is the one thing that I think about, is like, well, how do we scale like the story? How do we make sure the stories are good? How do we make sure they can be scaled to different stakeholders, different points in the process, yada, yada, yada. That is such a complex thing, but it's so important. This is, of course, my super biased individual opinion, but I think my entire career has only been as great as it has been because I'm very good at this. Like, when I decide to make a recommendation, I really like to pull together a quite solid story, and I usually have an easier time selling people on. And I've observed with content designers that I've worked with and with people that I've been on teams with that maybe were a little bit less successful content designers, this was exactly where they were struggling. They were often, or not often, sometimes, I would argue, they were better at like actually creating microcopy or coming up with good microcopy than I was. But the storytelling was just not solid enough. So it was very difficult for them to visualize it to stakeholders, to get that buy-in. So I think this is a very interesting part of the job that is much harder to teach, and I think very easily underestimated, because it takes a lot of energy if you're not very good at it yet.
Yeah, when you're saying those things, there were some thoughts going through here that it's like you kind of have to flex as well. You have to deliver a microcopy that is a big chunk of the work. You're going to be pushing a lot of words to screens and to experiences every day. But as you do that, I totally agree with building the story. And the challenge for me with building the story is that when you're doing that, you're thinking a little bit ahead. And sometimes the things that you're doing at that moment in terms of goals and expectations and priorities and strategy, those things are in the right now, or maybe in a month or two or three max. But you still have to continuously build that story. And sometimes it's like the way you tell that story is going to matter. It's like, can you break it down so you make it easier for the people who are thinking of the right now to make the foundation of bringing that story out possible together with you? You have to be able to help them digest that story and understand the story and invite them along. But sometimes we're thinking a little bit ahead. We're seeing the vision, you know, like, yeah, it's going to look great. We're starting small. We're starting with the limited scope, but we can build this thing into this. So there is the challenge and flexing between, we can do this right now to get to this place later with the story, with the same story, but the story is also going to evolve. It's also going to grow, you know, in different shapes.
I think you're spot on there. I think what also, I can give another example. I've been in a discussion, I'm not going to say when it was to keep it anonymous, but someone that I'm working with made a proposal like to go with a certain type of copy, recommended that to the team. The designer liked it. It kind of was taken forward to kind of the final review. And then stakeholders from a different department got involved and were not happy with the copy suggestion at all. And it became one of those typical situations. I think we all know it. A big Slack discussion about like, oh, like, why aren't we doing this copy instead? And like back and forth in like a small amount of minutes, like a very long thread. And then kind of forcing that content designer to defend their work a little bit, really go into, hey, this is what we've looked at, this is why I recommend this. And one of the reasons that was stated there was, and also it's according to our tone and voice and guidelines, we would prefer to go with this kind of term. For example, there was one specific term that these stakeholders didn't like. And then I got also involved in this discussion to try to figure it out and help out. And we ended up solving it in the end, of course, all good. But then later on, I received some feedback along the lines of, oh, like, we really didn't appreciate when it was just stated that the reason you're recommending this copy is because the guidelines say so, which was, of course, not specifically how that was formulated. But it was a really interesting thing because I realized, again, when we're thinking about how do we scale content design, and like, one of the first things we start doing, of course, is we try to standardize. We try to create guidelines so people can self-serve. So we have something to fall back on, to look at, to create that consistency. But then, and this was just one example of a situation I told, this has happened to me several times, where then still, even though there maybe is a standard, people, of course, will question the standard, which personally, I think that's a good thing. I think people should always question standards and systems and whatnot. But again, it makes it so much harder to then scale the discipline that is then also in a lot of cases understaffed. So I'm curious, long intro to ask you a question, but I'm curious, how do you feel about that? Like, what do you think is the key to really scaling what we do to more people, to more teams?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I mean, like, people tend to think indeed the guidelines are going to be the thing that it's going to help. I think there's an expectation there, the guidelines, like, that you're going to create the perfect set of guidelines. I think one of the things while you're trying to create something that scales, it's like, yes, it is a standard, but it's guidelines. It's supposed to give us guidance. I always try to say when we're in the works of creating or publishing guidelines, did it a few different times and feel in different shapes and sizes, you know, it's like, it's guidance. It can evolve, and we need feedback when it's not working as well, when it's getting confusing, you know, and we are probably watching that feedback come through, and we are also realizing that, but sometimes we don't know how people are using them. That feedback is very essential as well, so that we can keep evolving them. Language is also something that evolves. Our work is very centered around language and communication, you know, which are like very tied together. I think it's like when you're trying to scale that, the challenge is increasing because there you have to keep maintaining and evolving. And a lot of people don't think that's the case. They think they're out there. They're final, they're perfect, but guidelines are not meant to be the rule. You know, it's a standard that we should follow, but we can actually change and evolve and enrich. And I think not forgetting to go back and revisit when you start seeing signs that is not working anymore, because the language will evolve, the trends will change. Like, we are doing a lot of benchmarking all the time, but that's going to change over time because a very big new technical innovation might come out and shake things around. And then you're going to have to be able to, and scaling, that means that what you built, it's easy to turn around and, you know, and improve also in this quick turn of things without confusing people immensely. So it's like being careful how specific sometimes the guidelines are or what kind of principles you're putting into it. Make sure that there is room always for not being vague, but being clear enough to help people. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. It does. And you mentioned one thing there towards the end that I would also love to talk a little bit more about. You mentioned benchmarking. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. Like, how much benchmarking is a good amount? How much benchmarking is too much? Because again, here, I've seen a spectrum of ways of working with benchmarking. I've been in teams where I felt like we might as well just copy paste because everything was so benchmarking focused. There was like two or three competitors or other companies that designers thought were doing the work well. And then pretty much that was the work that was trying to be implemented without really adjusting it so much to our specific user case. But I've also been in other teams where benchmarking essentially wasn't a thing at all, which also kind of came with its, you know, ups and downs. So I'm curious to hear like your general thoughts on benchmarking, maybe how you use benchmarking in your day-to-day work.
Yeah, I really essentially use it as inspiration, and I it's not like inspiration is like everybody's doing this, let's do it as well. There's also the other side of inspiration, like this is actually really cool, but it's not gonna work for us. So this is like based on the things that we believe that we should be writing and communicating, this is not a fit at all, you know? So it's like you look at it, but you still have to be doing the critical thinking. How can we make sure this cool idea, it's also going to match the story that we're trying to tell or the identity of the product or the brand identity, you know? There is some work as well that sometimes needs to be done. There's also like sometimes the things that you do because others are doing, but it's not just because others are doing, it's because you're going to be helping to make the product more intuitive, you know, like we, like a lot of apps have very similar flows. You don't have, like you think about heuristics, then you don't have to be changing things all the time, you know, because part of the job is making it intuitive. And sometimes you're going to be doing things that are being done out there as trends as yeah. well, or just for the sake of keeping the product intuitive. So that, because people, we live in an era that everybody's overwhelmed with information
yeah.
and not having to relearn something all the time. And our job helps a lot with that as well. Like, what kind of words can we use here that are going to sound familiar as well? And designers are doing the same with the visual aspect of design, the interactional part as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's all of that combined.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that was a really good perspective and summary of the whole thing. I definitely agree with you, because I've also kind of gone back and forth in my own design process between using a lot of benchmarking to kind of specifically, like you say, also get my ideation started, and trying to avoid it at all costs, or even trying to only use benchmarking as a way to figure out what can we do differently, because I felt tired of the amount of things that we were doing that everyone else was already doing, which is not always a fun thing either. So yeah, thank you for sharing. Ayar, we're at the end of the recording, but I always like to ask guests in the end if there's one thing you want to leave the listeners with that you would love to say. It can be related to content design. It doesn't have to. This is your moment.
I think I'll stick to content design with this one. I think whether you're already experienced or also for the people who are thinking of starting, it's like there's a lot about like what you already are hearing and learning from what other people are doing, but try to always think about how the work would make sense for you in a way, because that's going to be something like thinking, having that clear, it's going to be something as well that is going to help when you actually start working with people and say, hey, this is how I can bring content design to support you. This is my style. But this is also how I can flex. This is also where I believe that we can shape things up together. So I think that's a little bit in a nutshell what I would say. Understand what your style is. Trust it as well, and communicate your story when you start working with content design.
I think that's really good advice. Thank you so much, Ayar, for joining today. I really appreciate it. I hope we'll see you on the podcast again sometime.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Hi to all the listeners out there.
Bye-bye. And that was it for today's episode of Content Rookie. Thank you so much for listening. As usual, if you have any questions or feedback, you can find all of our contact information in the info box. And I hope you'll stick around for the next episode. Bye-bye.